evening, with several councils still to declare. Make no mistake, we're on course for a Labour majority at the next general election, Keir Starmer said, having previously urged caution within his shadow team. The Liberal Democrats also had a good showing in the south of England against the Tories, winning more than 400 seats and lifting their hopes of being kingmakers in a hung parliament at the next general election. Among their gains were Windsor and Maidenhead, the local council of former Prime Minister Theresa May, and Stratford-upon-Avon, the seat of the former Chancellor Nadeem Zahawi. The Scottish National Party SNP also held out the prospect of a hung parliament, with the SNP's Westminster leader Stephen Flynn saying it was increasingly clear that the Scottish Nationalist Party can hold the balance of power after the next general election. Rishi Sunak and his party chairman Greg Hands attempted to put a positive spin on the results, insisting there had been no groundswell of switching from Conservatives to Labour. However, some Tory MPs expressed upset at the loss of so many councillors from 2019's already low base. One of Rishi Sunak's Cabinet Office ministers, Johnny Mercer, an MP in Plymouth, where Labour took control of the local council, said the party had to improve its response to the cost of living crisis and also to inflation. At his local county, said, "We've got to do better and we've got to learn from tonight." One Conservative MP described the losses to the Liberal Democrats and Greens in the south of England as a bloodbath. "Frankly, looking at the results, the only way we're going to win is to fight tooth and nail for the north and Midlands, as large chunks of the south of England are gone." And there I say there seems to be a clear correlation in areas we're holding on and active Tory MPs. Those where the MPs are less than visible, we're being punished. Meanwhile, allies of Boris Johnson linked to the Conservative Democratic Organisation CDO suggested that Rishi Sunak should face a confirmatory vote of members and that no one should rule out a comeback for the former Prime Minister. David Campbell Bannerman, the chair of the Conservative Democratic Organisation, an ally of Boris Johnson, told Times Radio he blames Rishi Sunak because he brought down Boris, and claimed Conservative MPs would act out of self-preservation to replace the Prime Minister. Other Conservative MPs were more sceptical, with a former Boris Johnson supporter, Michael Fabricant, saying, "Part of the whole problem with the Conservatives is not only the cost of living crisis, but what happened last year. So if we start to repeat that, then we not only will not win the next general election, we won't deserve to." Boris Johnson is still waiting the verdict of the Privileges Committee inquiry into whether he misled Parliament over Partygate. And some of Rishi Sunak's supporters blamed the former Prime Minister and the turmoil of the past year for putting voters off the Conservative Party. The Reuters news agency has also covered the story and tells us more. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Conservatives suffered steep losses in Friday's local election results, undermining his attempt to revive their fortunes and emboldening the opposition Labour Party before a national vote expected next year. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak came to power in October following a year of political scandals, surging inflation and stagnant economic growth. In office, he has faced a cost of living crisis, mounting concern about healthcare and widespread industrial action. While governing parties often struggle at midterm elections, the council seats in England are the largest and possibly last test of voter sentiment before the next general election due in January of 2025 at the latest, with a majority of councils counting their votes, which do not affect the government's majority in Parliament. The Conservatives had a net loss of 943 seats, while the Labour Party added 486 seats, and the Liberal Democrats gained 353 seats. Labour said they were now on track for power at the next general election. A Sky News projection based on the voter share of the early results said Labour could garner 36 to 38% of the vote at the next national election, making them the biggest party, with the Conservatives at 28 to 30%. The projection said Labour Party might fall short of a majority, though that could depend on how it fares in Scotland, where it is competing to take seats from the Scottish National Party, SNP, and which did not hold local elections. A similar BBC projection said Labour would get 35% at a general election and the Conservatives 26%, and some in Rishi Sunak's party voiced their disquiet over the results. Labour won control of Swindon Borough Council, a town in southwest of England where Labour leader Keir Starmer launched his election campaign, and which has always voted for lawmakers for the government party since 1983. No spin, no gloss. This is a dreadful set of results, said Justin Tomlinson, Conservative lawmaker in Parliament for Swindon North. The party collectively needs to take this as a wake-up call to refresh and to renew.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Russia has accused Ukraine of attacking the Kremlin with drones in a failed assassination attempt to kill President Vladimir Putin, vowing retaliation for what it has called a terrorist attack. Moscow has said the two drones were used in the alleged attack on Putin's residence in the Kremlin's citadel overnight, adding that the drones were disabled by electronic defenses.
It is technically possible. Ukraine has several types of drones that can fit the profile. For example, its newly developed UJ-22 drone can actually fly the distance. It's a commercial drone that they acquired from China. It's Mugen 5 cargo drone, which can be basically purchased online and could be refitted into a military drone. That drone can fly several hundred kilometers, and it was used in previous attacks.
Kremlin statement said, "We regard these actions as a planned terrorist act and an attempt on the president's life carried out on the eve of Victory Day, the May 9 parade, at which the presence of foreign guests is also planned."
And of course, attacks of this kind, if they are in fact carried by Ukrainian military, are meant to keep the Russian military off balance by forcing them to reallocate and rededicate air defense resources to specific places like Moscow, probably at the expense of other regions, including, for example, Russian military inside Ukraine proper that has to have enough air defense and electronic warfare protection.
Separately, the Speaker of Russia's parliament demanded the use of, quote, weapons capable of stopping and destroying the Kiev terrorist regime, response to the alleged attack on Kremlin. However, Ukraine denied any involvement in the alleged drone operation. Kiev has said the attack was, quote, staged by Moscow.
The Russians may try to leverage this narrative around an assassination on Putin to then up their game with regards to pretext to up their game to go after Zelensky himself. But they've been trying to do that anyway since the beginning of the war. There's plenty of reporting that indicates Russian kind of kill teams were out there trying to hunt down both Zelensky and his family. So it's mainly, I think, a rally around the flag effect that the Russians are going for.
Meanwhile, Ukraine says Russia has targeted cities in a new wave of missile strikes and shelling across the country. Officials and media outlets say multiple explosions were heard in the capital, Kiev, and elsewhere. Blasts caused by Russian shelling were also reported in the southern Zaporizhzhia region and the port city of Odessa. Kiev and some central and eastern Ukrainian regions have announced air alerts following the Russian statements accusing Ukraine of attacking the Kremlin. There are now some reports that Ukrainian forces have begun their counterattack in Bakhmut. Russian officials have said Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russia will have no benefit and will only lead to more bloodshed. The U.S. and its allies have put much hope in the offensive. However, leaked documents show Western military officials do not expect Ukraine to regain as much territory. Ukrainian forces have also been using lots of manpower and other resources fighting in Bakhmut. The intensifying crisis comes amid fresh U.S. military aid to Ukraine. The U.S. is sending another $300 million military aid package to Ukraine, including, for the first time, short-range air-launched rockets, deepening its involvement in the war in defiance of repeated warnings by Russia. The package includes Hydra-70 rockets, which are unguided projectiles fired from aircraft. It also includes artillery rounds, 155-millimeter howitzer cannons, anti-tank missiles, and mortars. The Pentagon has also sent at least 20 high-mobility artillery rocket systems, HIMARS, to Ukraine. HIMARS systems, which are made by Lockheed Martin, are intended to be a core component of Ukraine's fighting force in the future. The package brings the total amount of U.S. military aid to about $36 billion. The U.S. is still drawing funds for military assistance to Ukraine from the $45 billion aid package that Congress authorized in December.
Running against Russia, being nasty to Russia, is very popular. But I'll tell you what's not popular. More than 60% of the American people do not like all the money we're spending on Ukraine. And the American media is not reporting that, and it's also not reporting that there's demonstrations are going every weekend in Europe, particularly in Germany. There's a lot of demonstrations, not about the pipeline, against the war, the money that's being spent on Ukraine, and the whole notion of that war, and the whole rationale for the war. And you can almost understand why Biden wanted to keep Germany from having the option to open the pipeline.
The $45 billion is expected to be exhausted by the summer, meaning the White House might ask Congress for more funds soon. The U.S. and its Western allies have kept feeding Ukraine with massive amounts of arms since the start of the war last year. Moscow has time and again warned that military assistance will only prolong the war.
A well-known resistance actor within the Palestinian prisoners movement, Hador Adnan, has passed away on the 86th day of his hunger strike inside an Israeli prison following two decades of arrests. Hador spent nearly a fifth of his life behind bars, arrested 12 times by Israeli forces and subjected to over 8 years of captivity. He used hunger strikes to take power back and mobilize the world outside his prison cell in support of the Palestinian prisoners' struggle. Sustained arbitrary arrests and medical neglect led to Khadr's death. The Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council thus viewed Khadr's killing as premeditated murder by the Israeli regime. Israeli prison services were holding Khadr in solitary confinement and refused his family visitation rights right up to his death. He survived by his wife and 9 children. In his lifetime, Hador Adnan carried out 6 hunger strikes. His first protest in 2004 lasted 25 days and popularized hunger strikes as an accessible means of resistance within the regime's military prison system. His second hunger strike in 2012, that lasted 66 days, was joined by hundreds of prisoners and triggered an international movement for the freedom of Palestinian prisoners. In 2015, he went on his third hunger strike for 56 days against another administrative detention. In 2017, Hador was again arrested and went on a 58-day hunger strike. His fifth 25-day-long strike was directed at his penultimate arrest in 2021. During his most recent arrest in February, Israeli forces raided his home and terrorized his family. Hador was no stranger to civil disobedience, therefore responded by immediately going on an open hunger strike. Israeli prison services retaliated with isolation orders, renewed every 2 weeks without review. He was held under deplorable conditions and was subjected to regular abuses. When Hador fell seriously ill in April, ISP refused to transfer him to a hospital. Hador was found unconscious in isolation in Ramallah Prison Clinic on May 2nd. Using deliberate medical neglect, indefinite isolation, and detention extensions, the regime foresaw saw and facilitated Khadr's death. He was killed behind the bars, a fate shared by over 233 Palestinian political prisoners. The international community's failure to intervene amplifies past evidence that international law is just a tool for the colonizer regime of Israel, not Palestinians. It shows that the international community aids and abets the Israeli regime's crimes by its deafening silence that today rings loud after the death of Khadr Adnan. Palestinians rallied in Gaza City as shops closed during a general strike following the death of Palestinian hunger striker Khadr Adnan in Israeli custody. In his hometown near Jenin, in the occupied West Bank, Adnan's 9-year-old son, Ali, led a protest march. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya described the death of Adnan, who was arrested in the occupied West Bank, as a deliberate assassination.
The Palestinian cabinet holds the Israeli occupation, the prison authorities and all its agencies fully accountable for the martyrdom of Khadr Adnan. And we consider this a deliberate assassination by rejecting his request for release, neglecting him medically and keeping him in his cell despite the seriousness of his health condition.
Also, different Palestinian factions held the regime responsible for his death, saying that Israel will pay dearly for its crime.
The occupation bears full responsibility, and we will carry out our role in confronting those crimes and those assaults, in particular this crime which led to the martyrdom of Sheikh Hero Khadr Adnan.
Gaza-based Hamas resistance movement has also warned that the Israeli crime will not go unanswered. Also, the Fatah movement of President Mahmoud Abbas has called for immediate international action in support of Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails. According to Palestinian Prisoner Society, 4,900 Palestinian detainees are currently in Israeli jails, with 1,000 of them being held in administrative detention without charge. That's the highest number since 2003. People squeezed by inflation and demanding economic justice took to streets across Europe to mark May Day in an outpouring of worker discontent not seen since before the worldwide COVID-19 lockdowns. But what is May Day and why is it celebrated on May 1st? Also referred to as International Workers' Day, people across the world commemorate the contributions of workers and the labor movement on this day. Although observed as an ancient Northern Hemisphere spring festival initially, May 1st became associated with the labor movement in the late 19th century, after trade unions and socialist groups decided to designate it as a day in support of the working class people. The decision was taken in memory of Chicago's Haymarket Affair, which took place on May 4, 1886, when a violent clash broke out between the police and labor protesters. The incident happened after a bomb went off at Haymarket Square in Chicago, where the police had arrived to break a peaceful rally. Ultimately, 7 police officers were killed and 60 others were injured before the violence ended. It's estimated that 4 to 8 civilians died and 30 to 40 were wounded. Many of the protesters who were demonstrating against workers' rights violations, long work hours, poor working conditions, low wages, and child labor were arrested and served terms of life imprisonment, death sentences, and so forth. And those who died were hailed as Haymarket martyrs. The Haymarket Affair had a lasting effect on the workers' movement and helped push forward the demands for better working conditions across the world. This year's May Day events unleashed pent-up frustration after 3 years of COVID-19 restrictions. For months, Europe has seen a series of strikes as workers demand higher wages in the face of record-high inflation rates. In the 19-nation euro currency zone, the annual inflation rate was at an all-time high of 10.6% in October. It retreated slightly to 10.1% in November, but that was still the second highest monthly rate since the creation of the euro in 1999. Hundreds of thousands of people massed in cities around France to vent their anger against President Emmanuel Macron's pension reform. Protests took a violent turn as the day progressed, with protesters and security forces clashing. Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin told reporters that at least 108 police officers were wounded, with 291 detained across the country. Protesters threw projectiles at police and broke windows of business buildings, including banks and state agents in Paris. Security forces used tear gas and water cannons in return. Trade unions had called for more than 300 rallies and vowed to continue fighting even after the changes were signed into law. Protests had started largely peacefully, although police in Paris arrested 22 people, while in Lyon, police used tear gas to disperse crowds after bank windows were smashed. Sophie Binet, leader of the CGT union, said Macron's pension reform had left her isolated.
You just have to look at the procession behind. You can see that today is a historic May Day. There hasn't been such an important May Day in France since 1936, so we can't talk about running out of steam. We can't talk about decay. We can see that this day of mobilization is a stinging denial of all the bets made by the government and of the choice that the government was thinking of making to force us to turn the page.
Protesters mobilized against President Emmanuel Macron's recent move to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. Organizers see pension reform as a threat to hard-fought worker rights, while Macron argues it's economically necessary as the population ages.
Canada and one of the largest industrial actions in the country's history. Some 155,000 public workers are on strike in a dispute with the government over pay. While wages are a primary sticking point, the unions also want remote work included in their collective agreement. Cleaners and cooks, clerks and maintenance workers, tradespeople, Coast Guard search and rescue teams, teachers, firefighters, and workers who process employment insurance, passport applications, and immigration documents have now walked out of their jobs.
And I can tell you that we do not have a tentative agreement. The Public Service Alliance of Canada, 155,000 members, will be on strike as of 12:01 a.m. We will remain at the table. We will remain for as long as it takes during the strike. And we will remain on strike until the government addresses our key issues.
The strike has already disrupted public services in various sectors. Lawyers say the strike has affected everyone from refugee claimants whose hearings are cancelled to sponsored relatives stuck in limbo and from migrant workers to foreign students. The workers' union have failed to reach an agreement with the federal government in an effort to bring the industrial action to an end. On Saturday, the Canadian government negotiators presented the striking public workers with what they called a final offer. The Treasury Board, which oversees public administration, said details are being kept to the negotiating table, but the proposal included an enhanced wage offer and addressed issues including telework, seniority, and contracting. In a statement, the Treasury Board called the offer fair, competitive, and reasonable. The offer, however, has so far failed to bring the strikes to a halt. The workers are escalating their strike action in a bid to block several Canadian ports to pressure the government to get their demands met, including raising wages in line with the cost of living crisis and the soaring inflation. This is while inflation in Canada rose to a peak of more than 8% last June. It is expected to remain above 3% until the fourth quarter of this year. The strikes in Canada come as the country is gripped with an unfathomable economic crisis that includes soaring food insecurity. A chief executive of one of the country's leading food banks, the Daily Bread, said hundreds of thousands of people stream in each month to get food.
We are absolutely in a food crisis in the country and certainly in the city of Toronto. Before the pandemic, we saw about 60,000 clients saying, I'm food insecure. And that number this past March is 270,000. It has escalated by four times, and in a country as wonderful as Canada is, it just shouldn't be that way.
Hetherington said of the newcomers to the 128 food banks across the Toronto area affiliated with the Daily Bread, many have full-time jobs but still can't make ends meet. Visitors to food banks in other parts of Canada also echo sense of despair and need with long queues to get something to eat at food banks. Hetherington said accommodations, both rentals and homes for sales, are out of reach for many Canadians across the country. This comes at a time when a lengthy period of higher rates could force an increasing share of highly indebted Canadians to reset their mortgages at levels that squeeze their finances. But regardless of all the economic hardships the Canadian people are going through, the government of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau spent 1.32% of its GDP on defense in the fiscal year of 2021-2022. Canadian authorities also continue with their pledge to provide Ukraine with military support in its war with Russia. After all, Canada has been one of the most vocal supporters of Ukraine and has provided billions of dollars in financial and military assistance to Kyiv since January 2022. Apart from that, Canada is the sixth largest contributor to NATO's common funded budget by allocating 13.7% of defense spending on major equipment in 2021 and 2022. Canadian authorities claim that the assistance is for Ukraine in what they call its fight for democracy. They, however, know perfectly well that they are using billions of dollars of the Canadian taxpayers' money to inject into a war which does not serve Canada at all and only favors the expansionist policy of the United States. Instead, if this money is allocated to address Canada's internal economic concerns, what else can force more than 150,000 Canadians to walk out of their jobs and call for better pays, which would subsequently disrupt all public services and make public and private sectors dysfunctional?
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Chinese officials have always warned the United States about selling weapons to Taiwan. Chinese experts are saying America is trying to make instrumental use of Taiwan to contain China, but that these actions are very dangerous. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. China Daily has covered this story and tells us more. Beijing says Washington should halt arms sales to Taiwan since the U.S. is turning the island into a powder keg. China's foreign ministry spokesperson Mao Ning made the remark with reference to a Taiwan-U.S. defense industry forum held in Taipei on Wednesday, 3rd of May, where a delegation of U.S. arms dealers called for deeper cooperation between Washington and Taipei. The spokesperson said, lately, the U.S. and the Taiwan authorities have been stepping up military collusion, adding, it is further proof that the United States is turning Taiwan into a powder keg, which only spells trouble for our Taiwan compatriots. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said, U.S. arms sales to the Taiwan region seriously violates the One China principle and the three China-U.S. joint communiques. Mao Ning added, China firmly opposes them. Mao Ning warned any external forces meddling in Taiwanese affairs may have to pay for their actions. She said, the Chinese side will take strong and resolute measures to firmly defend our sovereignty and our security interests. Any external forces that interfere in China's domestic affairs and undermine peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait shall bear the consequences and pay for their actions. Beijing regards the island as part of its own territory under the One China principle. In recent months, tensions between China and the United States have been rising over Washington's growing military and political support for Taiwan. China often conducts military exercises around the island as a warning to Taiwan's separatist forces and their collusion with the United States. Bloomberg News Agency has also covered this story and tells us more. Taiwan is reportedly in the process of buying 400 land-launched Harpoon anti-ship missiles from the United States, in a move that is expected to draw condemnation from China, which considers the self-rule island part of its own territory. Citing U.S.-Taiwan Business Council President Rupert Hammond Chambers and sources, the U.S. Daily reported recently that Taiwan was poised to purchase 400 missiles under a $1.17 billion contract announced by the Pentagon on 7th of April. At the time, the Pentagon said production was expected to complete by March 2029. Commenting on the news report, Taiwanese Defense Ministry spokesperson Sun Li Fang said, the ministry had previously disclosed information about the purchase, adding it was confident the deal would go according to schedule. In 2020, Taipei said it planned to obtain land-based Boeing-made Harpoon anti-ship missiles as part of its military modernization program. According to Bloomberg News Agency, Taiwan previously purchased a ship-launched version of Harpoon missiles, but the new contract marks the first time it will get the mobile land-based variant of the missile. Bloomberg cited U.S.-Taiwan Business Council President Rupert Hammond Chambers as saying the contract with Boeing was issued by the U.S. Naval Air Systems Command on Taiwan's behalf. Beijing views Chinese Taipei as an inseparable part of China, reportedly warning Washington against unwise provocations. China has previously warned Washington that providing the self-rule island with advanced weaponry would breach Chinese sovereignty and do severe damage to bilateral ties. The report comes just days after U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen in California and stressed the need to accelerate arms deliveries to the self-rule island. The website of Press TV has also covered this story and tells us more. Tensions between Washington and Beijing are now entering a rather dangerous phase. China has launched military drills around Taiwan in what it called a stern warning to the self-rule island. the United Sharp Sword, the three-day military exercises sent planes, ships, and personnel into the maritime areas and airspace up the Taiwan Strait off the northern and southern coasts of the island of Taiwan. At the outset, the Chinese military said the type of weaponry China will use during these military exercises would include long-range rocket artillery, naval destroyers, missile boats, air force fighters, and bombers. The military exercises were to include live fire drills off the coast of China's Fujian province, which faces Taiwan. The exercises follow a provocative meeting held in the U.S. state of California between Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen and the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy. China, which regards self-ruled Taiwan as part of its own territory, was enraged by this visit. Beijing has vowed to eventually take Taiwan over, by force if necessary. The military exercises by China came as a delegation of U.S. legislators, led by Chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee, Michael McCaul, was visiting Taiwan and met with Taiwanese leader Tsai Ing-wen. Michael McCaul claimed the delegation was in Taipei to show its support for the Democratic Island. Speaking at an event in Taiwan, Michael McCaul underlined that the visit was intended to demonstrate strong support for self-rule Taiwan. McCaul's trip to Taiwan was not the first such visit by a senior U.S. official to the self-rule island. Last August, then-U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan, along with a delegation of Democratic Party members of the House, to reaffirm Washington's support for Taiwan. Apart from Nancy Pelosi, some of the other high-ranking U.S. officials have, on numerous occasions, shown Washington's all-out support for Taiwan, including U.S. President Joe Biden. President Biden has given the strongest warning to Beijing, reiterating Washington's commitment to defending Taiwan's military in the event of an attack by China. Beijing has reiterated its sovereignty over the island, saying no individual force can hold China back from achieving the goal of national reunification. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Mao Ning said Beijing is firmly opposed to any form of official interaction between the United States and Taiwan. But what if China tries to reclaim Taiwan? In such a scenario, would the United States and its allies be able to prevent this from happening? While Beijing asserts that the self-rule island is an inseparable part of Chinese territory and that the future of Taiwan lies in reunification with the motherland, what objective is the United States seeking other than provocation? The pertinent question should be whether the United States would stay quiet and take no action if China were to station its forces and fleet around Central and Latin America or anywhere near U.S. borders. Undoubtedly, the security of Taiwan has the potential to be used as a political tool by the United States and NATO against Beijing. But a more dangerous scenario is one in which Taiwan could be used as a reason for conflict between the West and China, much like what is currently happening in Ukraine between the West and Russia.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of the speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei in a meeting with Iranian officials and the ambassadors of Islamic countries on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Fitr on April 22nd, 2023. The internal resistance of the Palestinians is the main reason for their progress. The more this resistance increases, the weaker the Zionist regime will become, and the more its disastrous situation can be seen. The desperate situation that the Zionist regime is in today, the Zionist regime's current situation is truly deplorable, is due to the steadfastness of the Palestinian youth. They are accepting the hardships and the dangers. In Quds, we see a large gathering of people taking part in spiritual retreats. The young people in different cities of the West Bank stand in front of the armed, vicious Zionist soldiers. They make sacrifices and they move forward. They have moved forward up until now, and it will continue to be the same. I believe that today the Zionist regime's power of deterrence has come to an end. This is what Ben-Gurion, one of the main founders and the former prime minister of the Zionist regime, had warned of decades ago, perhaps 60 years ago. He said that the regime would start to have problems whenever its power of deterrence ended. Today their power of deterrence has finished, or is near its end.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They know and realize this themselves, that their collapse and dissolution are near. This is again due to the blessings of the resistance front. It is due to the blessing of the Palestinian youth who have been able to continuously weaken, reduce, and destroy their enemy's power of deterrence. So, what should the Islamic world's strategy be regarding Palestine? Today, the Islamic world's strategy regarding Palestine should be to help the forces inside that country. The resistance front's endeavors are, of course, valuable. Wherever they are, just like us, we too are standing up for the Palestinian issue. The resistance front's endeavors are valuable. These efforts should be focused on strengthening those who are fighting and risking their lives inside Palestine. The last point is the following. We need to truly pay attention to this point. What is the reason for the escalation of the internal struggles in Palestine? It is because of their inclination towards Islam. We had seen what their situation was like before. Back when Islamic tendencies weren't popular among Palestinian groups. Now, some were communists and others were not communists, but they weren't Islamic. These developments did not exist.
You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Leader meets with thousands of workers and members of labor organizations. On Saturday, 29th of April 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, met with thousands of workers, members of labor organizations, and officials from Iran's Ministry of Cooperatives, Labor, and Social Welfare at the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah in Tehran. The meeting took place as we approach 1st of May, which has been designated as International Workers' Day. Here in the Islamic Republic of Iran, 1st of May also marks Workers' Day and Workers' Week. In this program, we discuss the leaders' points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. On Saturday, 29th of April 2023, the leader of the Islamic Revolution met with thousands of workers from all walks of life, both men and women, employed in various sectors of Iran's economy, who had traveled to this meeting from every corner of the Islamic Republic of Iran. To begin with, Ayatollah Khamenei said the purpose of this meeting was to highlight the importance of workers and the great value of their work and how important workers were to society. The leader emphasized the culture of work, how important it is to respect the rights of workers and to fully appreciate the value of workers and the work that they do. In Islam, work can be viewed as a way of attaining proximity to the Almighty, and hard work is valued just as much as great worship of the Lord. A hadith from the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Whoever manages to provide for his or her own living expenses through honest hard work, he or she will stand behind prophets of God and will benefit just as prophets of God will benefit on the Day of Judgment." Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader said, "I want to talk about the value of workers in our society. What I want is for people to realize how valuable our workers are. The term worker has a broad definition. The workers I'm talking about now are the laborers in industrial and agricultural settings, those who provide services and so on and so forth. I'm not addressing researchers, university professors and the such. They too are workers in a way, but they're not the ones that I'm addressing right now. Rather, it is you, the country's community of laborers. I want to talk about work, workers, and the responsibilities that we all have towards them. Firstly, how can we understand the importance of workers? From the importance of the work that they do, of course. Why is work important in society? You can understand the importance of workers from the importance of the work that they do. Work is what keeps a society alive. Work is the backbone of people's lives. Without work, there is nothing. The food we eat, the clothes we wear, the facilities that we use, that our lives depend upon, all of these have been attained through work. But who does this work? Well, workers, of course. So what is the value of a worker? The value of a worker is equal to the value of a society's existence. They're equal to the value of people's lives." In further remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "If no work is done in society, all these national assets will remain stagnant. We have mines, we have facilities, we have soil and water. If work is done, all of these things will be blessings. The mines will be worked upon, water and soil will be utilized, and life will continue. However, if no work is done, these natural resources will remain dormant and unutilized. Therefore, work is what makes our potential flourish. That is the significance of work. Once we understand the importance of work, That's when we realize how important a worker is. This is one point, and we must, first of all, have this knowledge about ourselves, about our workers and their communities. Commenting further, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "We should realize the importance of creating jobs and employment. The creation of jobs is important for various reasons. First of all, the country needs jobs. Our society needs to have work. And like I said before, if there is no work, there is no life. Secondly, a worker needs a job in order to run his or her life. Thirdly, workers have a spiritual and mental need to work. The Almighty God created human beings in such a way that, being idle, makes them bored. Work brings joy to a person's life. So the need to work is not just physical, it's also spiritual. Spiritually, we also need to work. People need to work. And fourthly, work prevents corruption. Unemployment is a source of corruption. Much of the corruption we see around us is the result of unemployment. Addiction is related to unemployment. Corruption is related to unemployment. Theft is related to unemployment. Divorce and breakup of families is also related to unemployment. So you see, the organizations that are responsible for creating jobs know how important it is for society to truly create work and jobs. They must make investments, and this is another point. Another thing I like to say regarding work is that there should be a direct relationship between income and work. According to the Holy Quran, nothing belongs to a person except what he or she strives for. People's income should be based on their effort, on their work. This is how society should be. This is very difficult to do, but what does this mean? It means that much of this easy money and easy gains are wrong. We need to put a stop to the culture of making easy money in this country. I said that this is a long-term, difficult task to achieve, but it must be done. Much of this use of intermediaries, middlemen, bribery, that is given and received in some places, usury, that is taking place in some economic sectors, and this taking advantage of relationships, resulting in people gaining an easy, hassle-free money without actually working. These are all harmful to society. People's income must be directly earned through hard work. As for his remarks, the leader said, one of the problems we have when it comes to global trade or even our domestic trade is the quality of the products that we manufacture. If workers are reassured and know that they will be able to afford things easily, if they know that they have job security, and if they're confident that their work will get better, the quality of the work that they do will also improve. Everyone should know this. Therefore, any effort to improve a worker's life is actually an effort to improve their work. It is an effort to improve the products that they make and the quality of their work. It is an effort to improve the country. It is an investment. If we try to solve the problems of the community of workers that have actually made an investment, it is not an expense, it is an investment. Everyone should know this. Officials should realize this. In the work that is related to the country's officials, be it government, parliament, or otherwise. Furthermore, the employers, investors, and entrepreneurs and the like also need to realize this point. Production is the backbone of our country. Manufacture and production is the backbone of our country. The backbone of our economy is also manufacture and production. And the backbone of production is, of course, workers. We must not let the worker, just that is the backbone, become weak. Another point is the need for a fair sharing of the income from work, which we have already discussed. Workers are human capital, and they're more effective than material capital. They create value for products, and this should be taken into consideration. The share of a worker who is skilled, experienced, well-trained, and innovative when it comes to creating value for the end product is much greater. His share of the income should therefore be accordingly much greater. Now, this does not mean that we want to challenge investors and the like. No, I don't recommend that at all. Investors, entrepreneurs, and workers are all necessary and they're all needed. If one of them is absent, there is nothing that others can do. We need all of them. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, talked about young people. The leader said, "The next group is made up of young people who are not seeking education or work. Our political, social, and economic experts need to really sit down and think about this. They should assist the government in this work. They need to help the government and think a way to help this group of young people. Unfortunately, some of our young people don't have jobs, and they're not seeking employment or a higher education. We have a significant number of young people who are in this category. These people are both young, and they're a capital. They're considered an asset, a capital for our country. They should not be wasted. We truly need to come up with a solution for this group of young people. And this is what I have said to experts and to managers, senior managers and government officials." In final remarks, the leader said, "In my view, the community of workers deserves admiration and respect. I truly respect and honour our workers in this country. On the one hand, I believe that, God willing, there needs to be a noticeable change and improvement in the life of workers in this country, considering the hard work that they do. On the other hand, I praise the community of workers from the bottom of my heart because of the way that they have stood up for Iran's economy. And they have helped this country. They have stood up to the enemies of this country as well. I wish you all the best. May Almighty God shower His blessings upon you."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Millions of struggling homeowners with tracker mortgages across the 27-nation Eurozone will soon start paying back even more following a decision by the European Central Bank to increase interest rates by a quarter of 1%.
We have covered a lot of ground in the last 9 months, right? Moving from minus 50 basis points to plus 300 basis points. We are continuing this hiking process.
Rents are going up as landlords with mortgages pass on the costs. The aim is to bring down inflation, but disgruntled unions insist the strategy won't work. It's all linked to energy sanctions against Russia. EU citizens are being financially pummeled. However, the bloc's leaders have just agreed on a huge additional package to arm Ukraine.